Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from medical bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov. And M&M Skylights, offering a wide range of Velux skylight products, installation, and maintenance services to customers from Boston to Portland and surrounding areas. More information at mmskylights.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, broadcasting from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for environmentalists to stop having a beef with us meat eaters, isn't it? If we just scaled down how much we consume, could we eco-minded carnivores have our steak and eat it too? Thank you, Marjorie. Joining us for his take on this, the $40,000 worth of caviar tucked in the Mueller report, and other headlines about food policy and food culture is Corby Kummer. He's an award-winning food writer, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hey there.
Hey, Corby Kummer. So I've been dying to get your take on the Stop and Shop strike. It lasted about 10 days. Now the workers have reached a deal with the company. But you sense that there was a lot of support, not just from political candidates, but just the time I live right near a Stop and Shop, you know, people going by tooting their horn and stuff. What'd you make of, and they've gotten a decent deal, too. What'd you make of this?
This is a really tough one because, of course, our heart goes out to the strikers and also the effectiveness of the strike. One, I think Saturday, they just decide, I'm going to leave those cupcakes uniced, the meat uncryovac'd, and out I go. And cheese in the slicer, bread in the slicer, and it was this really effective strike. And Stop and Shop was reported to be losing $2 million a day in last week leading up to Easter and Passover. So it was a very effective time to strike. Very effective strike. They were saying, stop cutting our pensions. We've been working here for years. Suddenly you're devaluing us. So how great that they did this, but the but is supermarkets and huge retail places are under siege from Amazon and other online retailers. And what is their future? And I don't know that this is a step ahead for workers at other bricks and mortar locations.
You know, Marjorie characterized, and I think that's what I read too, as a win for the union. I mean, clearly they stuck together and they did whatever you described, left the meat in the slicer or whatever that imagery was. But I have to say, as a former union guy, I think the jury's still out. You know, for example, tucked in the first Globe story, by Katie Johnson and John Hilliard after the settlement. Just one line I thought was pretty significant. The UFCW, the Food and Commercial Workers, in a statement said the agreement also maintains time and a half pay on Sundays for current members. One of the big issues for them was how current members, I had three of them, three of the workers who averaged about 40 years of service. They started in their teens in two of the three cases on TV with me the other night. One of the big issues was how future members are treated. So it's not a two-tiered pension, two-tiered pay kind of thing. And I think the power they have going forward is in great part going to be a function of how much did what they win accrue to the benefit not just of the current members, but about future hires. And so, again, if they're happy, I'm happy, but I think we have to reserve judgment about what the outcome and impact is.
But again, if you're in, as Corby says, a industry that could be dying, I mean, the brick-and-mortar supermarket, because of all this competition, in a way, I mean, they're going to do something,
I'm not criticizing them in the slightest. I'm just saying, let's see how they do for people who come in the future. They are apparently paid current members much better, and they're going to get pay raises than their non-union counterparts. The question is that going to hold?
But I guess justice-wise, it's much more harmful for someone who's been there for 20 years, 25, 30 years, to have something change than for the new people.
Yes, but their position, and this is the position of every decent union in this country, not there are many left vis-a-vis future hires, is that not only is it bad for the future person, who doesn't exist yet, at least as a worker, it's bad for us because when that new person is underpaid, has a rotten pension, crappy health care, if they have health care at all, depending on how many hours they work, it weakens the whole union. So we, who have been here for years, get weakened as well. That's what these guys articulated the other night on the show.
Well, I'll shut up in 1 second. So my argument then that the people at the T should continue to be able to get out after 20 years then because we don't want to upset the newer workers.
Forever, right, exactly.
Okay.
In any case, they did stay strong. And you know, one of the interesting things we're going to talk to our listeners about it afterwards is what's the impact? You know, do former customers after 10 days change their loyalties? I hope not. Are there going to be people who are pro-union types who almost never went there who are now going to go for the first time? Go ahead.
We have our eye on the future. And one of the things that I thought was great was public support for unions is at a 15-year high.
I know. It's amazing.
According to Gallup poll, quoting this Johnson and Hilliard story, with 62% of Americans voicing support for unions. That's great. But I would say that the outcome of this has to be management working with the union about figuring out the future for the new union workers.
So the thing I was unclear about, having read that story, are they selling at Stop and Shop now that they've reopened $40,000 jars of caviar, or am I confusing two stories, Corby?
The union negotiated a big cut of every $40,000 jar of caviar.
Can you
that
tell
was
us
part of this deal?
The latest, we know Paul Manafort. What did he have? Like ostrich jackets or whatever?
I don't know.
But tell us about the caviar.
This is a really amusing story by Ryan Sutton, who's a funny writer and did some of the best reporting about minimum wage. I mean, he really delved into the economics. But he wrote a comic item in Eater.com about something in the tucked in, as you said, to the Mueller report, is this tale of an operative for the newly elected president of Ukraine who says to Manafort, I've got that big jar of black caviar, which was worth $30,000 to $40,000. So a Post report, a Washington Post report, suggested maybe it was coded language for money.
That's what
but
I thought.
Ryan Sutton just ran with this story and said, so what would it look like, a Mercedes worth of caviar? And how big would that jar be? And the biggest size at Petrosian, which he lives down the street from, which sells caviar retail in New York City, in the, like West 56th and 7th Avenue, 1 kilogram cost $16,000. So he had trouble envisioning what it looks like. But I know what it looks like because a kilogram jar has this beautiful etched silver fish on it. And at the opening of guest quarters, the then guest quarters on Memorial Drive, a friend I won't name but might be listening to this show and I had access to these. They look like they're film reels. They're big, huge silver tins of caviar. And everybody was looking at them like, what is it? Is it jewelry? These glistening, beautiful black eggs? And she and I just decided we were going to have only caviar that night until our eyes bugged out, our own eyes bugged out. And we were so ill for the next 3 days that I'm not sure either of us has had caviar since.
By the way, when you said newly elected, you don't mean newly elected like the comedian who was elected 2 days ago. You mean the guy who was newly elected in 2010, I think it
was. Yeah, 2010. Yeah. Right. As in complete corruption that the new comedian is hoping to combat.
You know, I've had cheap caviar. There's no such thing as really, well, there is. I've had cheap caviar. I've never had wildly expensive caviar. Can you tell the difference?
Yes, I can. So Malasol means little salt. That's my favorite kind, and it's the least salty. The big stuff is glistening, it pops nicely, and it's big. You're paying for the size of it. It's also soft. There are so many ways, if you really like caviar, to have something affordable. You buy it in paste form, so it's kind of gummy and sticky, but has a really good flavor. Or what you buy is farmed caviar from the Northwest coast or the Canadian coast or the many places that are farming it sustainably instead of illegal beluga, which is so endangered that it's illegal to sell. And one of the things the Eater.com story by Ryan Sutton was speculating is it might have been so expensive because it was smuggled and contraband and illegal, which would make it even worse.
Paul Manafort would never do anything like that.
Never,
me.
No. Of course, his principles were much too high.
So, Corby Kummer, working for food stamps has become more popular in recent times. This great piece from the New Food Economy shows that it's not the people that are really making money here, the companies that run these programs, that they have not gotten people jobs, that the programs are very expensive, and in some cases they violated participants' civil rights and been accused, at least in one case, of coerced labor. The idea is that you can't get food stamps unless you work a certain amount of time. This story is out of Wisconsin. It sounds horrible.
This is the most chilling story of exploitation of laws. And so we've been watching for years the Trump administration try to kick people off the rolls of SNAP, of food assistance, by using this work requirements for ABODs, able-bodied working adults. And LePage in Maine tried to do this, and Wisconsin, Scott Walker did it successfully. So what happens? Companies come in and contract with a state to say, we'll provide job training, we'll provide job access, because now you have these requirements. And, you know, these stranded people who want their food stamps have to sign up for these services. What do these services try to do? They try to, like, turn them into indentured servants by saying, we've found a job for you. It's 2 hours away. There's no public transport. But it's the only job you can take. And if you don't take it, you're going to be kicked off the rolls and you won't get your food stamps. So they're doing patently illegal things. They're not following up on giving the job training. They're postponing the job training, running out the clock, and so that the poor recipients have not been able to prove that they have found work or they have looked for work because the service has given them the runaround. It's this horrible bureaucratic nightmare in which big middlemen, this was called Maximus and ResCare, make money off this penurious anti-poor people requirement, and the poor people are kicked off the rolls anyway.
So, Corby's good news, because Marjorie and I are really care a lot about climate change, climate disruption, as Marjorie calls it, and we just read in Mother Jones, you don't have to be a vegan, thank God, to be a climate-friendly eater.
No.
So what's the message?
Flexitarian, Jim.
Flexitarian,
that's what it is.
That's
what we can be.
No, flexitarian is pretty extreme, too, apparently. But what's the deal? What's the instruction we take away from this, Corby Cummer?
So, first of all, I have to say Tom Philpott in Mother Jones is one of the best writers about food, sustainability, climate change. I rejoice whenever I see his byline. So this is a piece talking about the two studies that we have been talking about, if you recall, Jim Browdy, the Eat Lancet study and then the Lancet study about climate change right after that, both this year, 2019, saying that it's time to change your meat eating ways, but especially beef, because the money graph in Tom Philpott's story reminds us that meat production, everything from cow burps, remember, it's burps.
I know,
coming
thank
out the
good.
Front
I, please.
To fertilizer. Okay. It's burps. Generates about 14.5% of all greenhouse gases, equal to the world's transportation system. And 12 times the amount of greenhouse gases per calorie as poultry, 56 times as much as fruit and vegetables, 100 times as much as rice. And America is the biggest beef-eating country of any. So it's time to just have the amount of one or two hamburgers a week. So are you okay with this, Marjorie? Flexitarian diet, 1.5 ounces of meat a day, three hamburgers worth a week, and you'll help cut these emissions by 52%.
Okay.
Can you get behind that?
I'm going to ask you a stupid question. I actually don't eat much red meat. I just don't like it. I never have. But it is. I was confused about the status of chicken.
No,
here.
Beef is. As he just said, beef is far worse than chicken.
Yeah. Okay. So that was what I was confused about because of this chart. You know, they had everything lumped in on this chart. You know, they had meat consumption, poultry consumption, chicken consumption. So where is chicken on this flexitarian diet?
Chicken is terrible. It raises terrible humane issues and pollution issues,
okay,
especially humane issues, and you should be worried about it for another reason, because you should be worried every day, Marjorie.
Okay, well, I am worried every day, Corby, as you well know. So the question is, can you have 1.6 things of chicken a week?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes, beef
yeah,
is the worst.
If you're thinking
by
of the
far.
Environment, it's beef.
Yeah, okay. But okay. Yeah, I think that's not a problem.
But can I tell you, you know, if again, I don't mean to disparage whatever you're doing, Marjorie. I have totally converted to Soylent Squares myself.
Oh, God.
Now, about, I don't know, three
it's
or four.
Because you're an avatar.
I am. About 4 or 5 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, Sue O'Connell, our buddy, walks into the studio with this disgusting tan-looking thing and says, do you want to take a taste of this? And apparently it was Soylent the liquid, Which, do you remember the taste of that?
I do. It was disgusting. And you know something?
Disgusting.
Chelsea, our producer, said that it's ironic, you know, the name Soylent, because it's supposed to be that Soylent Green, which is about eating people or whatever it was. I mean, this is the grossest name for a product. They're never going to get anywhere continuing to
call it
Soylent.
Well, wait a second. But they used to be into the notion that taste was not only irrelevant, but bad taste was okay. But the reason we brought it up is apparently they're moving from liquid to solid Soylent, and they're moving from tasteless and unappetizing to theoretically appetizing. Is that true?
Well, you know, they're saying that they are now a complete nutrition platform you can enjoy any time of the day in multiple formats, which is enough to gag you if the idea of eating a Soylent Square isn't.
You know what you could do? Hey, Corby, before you continue, can you go back to the beginning and explain for the Silicon Valley types or wherever this started, what was the original notion behind Soylent?
So the original notion was you're too busy to stop and have food that it takes too much time to chew. So this liquid diet will give you all the nutrients you need and fill you up. And a book that I have recently reviewed for a very large media outlet, and we will discuss it when the review comes out, has an account of eating Soylent for lunch every week. And it is really like the dystopian future of the movie that the name Soylent came from, because you lose all sensory clues. You lose all sense of the time of day. But it was adopted enthusiastically by Silicon Valley guys. Guys, the ones we were talking about last week, like Jack Dorsey, who give up food for the
entire
weekend.
Doesn't eat on the weekends, sick.
Ridiculous 5-2, they eat 5 days a week, only one meal, then nothing for 2 days. So these same bros were having just Soylent for a while, and now they can have these bars because Soylent does have its fan base.
It does.
Apparently it's 65% men, 35% women. Sells unusually well at Grand Forks, North Dakota, the company said, offering no theory as to why. And you can get it in airports and car wash waiting rooms.
Have you ever tasted this stuff?
No. The idea seems like the best emetic possible. I can't imagine it, but you two have. I have read about people, they buy the powder, and they mix it with water, although it's also sold ready to drink. And so a lot of the fans on Reddit, it has like 30,000 fans on a Reddit listserv, were saying, I just want more flavors in the packets. You know, why aren't they giving us more? Whereas Soylent itself has been so attacked that they say, oh, no, we don't say you should give up food. Because the original founder was saying, I gave up food and I'm a better guy for it and I feel better. Now they're much more careful in their PR messages and say, no, have it as an adjunct to food. We don't say you should give up food.
You know, before you go, you just reminded me of the discussion we had with you last week about this loser, Jack Dorsey,
the Twitter guy.
In every way except his billions.
Can you imagine, it's Friday, you're finished work for the week. We finished pretty early, two-ish on Friday, whatever time, Corby, you finish at the tough school of whatever. Can you imagine facing the weekend knowing you're not going to eat again till Monday? I mean, what is up with that?
Idea of the perceived ecstasy that you will feel by the end of the weekend as you are depriving yourself of everything but oxygen and all nutrients. It's so dangerous. And the idea that these cultural icons promote this and then come into actual nutritionists who have to say, no, this is dangerous for your body. Don't do it.
Corby, good to talk to you as always.
Corby, thank you very much. And I'll let you know how I make out in my new flexitarian diet.
Yes, so you will. And I will be asking my colleagues at the Beard Awards this Friday about Gordon Ramsay.
Oh, good luck.
Oh,
we didn't know it was Friday.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Yes,
we're rooting for you.
Absolutely
rooting
for you.
And I'm rooting for all my distinguished colleagues whose great work deserves to be celebrated.
That is sick.
Corby Cummer, thank you very much.
See you, Corby.
Thank you.
The food writer Corby Cummer joins us every week. He's an award-winning food writer. He's up for a James Beard Award this Friday. We hope he prevails.
For his piece about Trump wines.
That's right, which is a great piece about Trump wines, is that vineyard that the president has. Corby's also a senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Up next, a new Frontline documentary looks at the debate over abortion and how it's playing out in Pennsylvania. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.